This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The vice presidential debate between Vice President Mike Pence and challenger Kamala Harris in Salt Lake City, Utah, wrapped up with the coronavirus pandemic being front and center. The two candidates were seated behind plexiglass barriers and greeted one another from a distance because of coronavirus restrictions. Harris criticized the Trump administration's handling of the pandemic in her opening statement.
210,000 dead people in our country in just the last several months. Over 7 million people who have contracted this disease. One in five businesses closed. We're looking at frontline workers who have been treated like sacrificial workers. We are looking at over 30 million people who in the last several months had filed for unemployment.
Vice President Pence, the head of the coronavirus task force, said that concern for the American people was paramount to the President Trump.
Before there were more than five cases in the United States, all people who had returned from China, President Donald Trump did what no other American president had ever done. And that was he suspended all travel from China, the second largest economy in the world. Now, Senator Joe Biden opposed.
And the debate moderated by Susan Page of USA Today was more reserved and less explosive than the first presidential debate between President Trump and a former Vice President Joe Biden. President Trump returned to the Oval Office at the White House Wednesday just 2 days after being released from a medical facility after being diagnosed with COVID-19. In a video released on his Twitter account, the president thanked his doctors and praised the experimental antibody treatment he received at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin is decrying what he called Joe Biden's sharp anti-Russian rhetoric, but praising the Democratic presidential nominee's comments on arms control. In his first detailed statements on the U.S. presidential campaign, Putin also lamented President Donald Trump's failure to improve relations between Moscow and Washington, but he blamed this on a bipartisan consensus on the need to contain Russia to curb the country's development. He also said Biden's reference to Trump last week as Putin's puppy was in fact a compliment to Russian influence and power. Putin's comments seemed intended to serve multiple purposes, playing to Mr. Trump's side by casting the Democrats in a pro-Moscow light, while at the same time hedging his bets with Biden. Farmer Giant Roche says the problems at a UK warehouse are delaying shipments of a variety of testing products at a time when coronavirus infection rates are rising around Britain. AP correspondent Karen Shamus.
Roche informed doctors about the problem at its distribution centre in Sussex in a letter that advised customers to prioritise essential services only. Alan Wilson, president of the Institute of Biomedical Science in the UK, says the impact of the shipment delay will depend on how long the delay will be.
If we're talking weeks, then yes, there is the potential here to significantly impact on our ability to deliver diagnostic testing.
Britain's National Health Service needs the materials to conduct blood tests and screening for diseases like diabetes and cancer. Roche issued a statement saying that they are prioritising the dispatch of COVID-19 tests and doing everything they can to ensure that there is no impact on the supply to the NHS. Karen Chamas, London.
The two Islamic State militants from Britain appeared before a U.S. federal court on Wednesday to face charges in gruesome campaign of torture, beheadings, and other violence against four Americans and others captured and held hostage in Syria. U.S. Attorney Zachary Terwilliger spoke after the two militants from Britain made their initial appearance in federal court. He said that there will be a detention hearing Friday at 11 a.m. And that's where their attorneys can argue if they choose, so they will be released pending trial. Shafi al-Sheikh and Alexander Cody are two of four men dubbed the Beatles by the hostages they held captive because of their British accent. Louisiana is bracing for a possible hurricane for the sixth time of the unprecedented 2020 season. Forecasters say Hurricane Delta should make landfall in the state sometime Friday and could bring winds of well over 100 miles per hour. Delta and people prepared Wednesday to once again flee in the state's barrier islands and move boats to safe harbor while emergency officials considered ordering evacuations. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS and the African Union conclude preventive diplomacy mission to Ivory Coast.
One thing that the mission was able to achieve is that it encouraged all stakeholders to promote dialogue and to commit themselves to the organization and holding of a credible, transparent, and inclusive election, respectful of human rights.
The U.S. envoy to Mali urges post-coup elections and reform. Africa gave the world a lesson in tackling COVID-19. Many Zimbabwe teachers are still refusing to go back to school. And Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera is on a three-day visit to neighboring Tanzania.
The economies of Tanzania and Malawi are inextricably linked, and so he has come to reach agreements and strike deals related to trade.
And Somali American volunteers are making sure African diaspora is counted in this year's U.S. Census. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, African Union, and the United Nations will send observers to monitor Ivory Coast October 31st presidential election. A joint mission Wednesday concluded a visit to Ivory Coast. It called on all parties to dialogue and commit to holding credible, transparent, and inclusive elections. The visit came at a time that tensions are high in Cote d'Ivoire ahead of the election after the Constitutional Council excluded former President Laurent Gbagbo and Gion Saro in the voters' list. The opposition has called for postponement of the election for 3 months to make possible national dialogue on contentious issues such as reform of the Independent Electoral Commission and the Constitutional Council. Aderemi Ajibewe is Director of Political Affairs for ECOWAS.
One thing that the mission was able to achieve is that it encouraged all stakeholders to promote dialogue and to commit themselves to the organization and holding of a credible, transparent, and inclusive election, respectful of human rights. Secondly, also, the mission encouraged that there should be a sort of security of the electoral process, as well as the protection of physical safety of candidates and their supporters before, during, and after the elections of 31st October 2020. But however, as you rightly said, there are still some divergent views, given the fact that the opposition, they demand certain things. One, the reconstitution of the Independent Electoral Commission, the suspension of the activities of the Constitutional Court, withdrawal of the candidacy of President Alassane Ouattara, the issue of political violence, and then the release of political prisoners. Also, return without exception of the exiles. You know about the exiles, Laurent Gbagbo, as well as Soros. Then finally, they also asked for a designation of a facilitator or a mediator to conduct the national reconciliation. But however, we appeal to them that boycotting is not the best option for opposition parties. We've seen that it's never helped in Togo, and it has never helped in some other member states.
You met with President Alassane Ouattara. Did you address the issue of former President Laurent Gbagbo's and Gion Soro's participation in the election? Remember, the African Court of Human and People's Rights has ruled in favor of the inclusion of Mr. Gbagbo and Mr. Soro.
Actually, during the stay of the high level, the joint mission was received in audience by His Excellency Alassane Ouattara, the president. He welcomed the members of the joint and expressed his gratitude for the manifestation of the international solidarity with the Republic of Cote d'Ivoire. He also reaffirmed to the mission his determination to promote peace in Cote d'Ivoire and the entire sub-region. In this regard, he assured us that he will spare no effort to ensure the holding of a credible, inclusive, transparent, and peaceful presidential election in Cote d'Ivoire. But however, as you might have known, this issue of the African human rights decision was also mentioned by other opposition candidates. And with President Laurent Gbagbo's case, what I got to understand there is that presently the case of former President Laurent Gbagbo is still pending, and there's no way they could have allowed him.
ECOWAS this week lifted sanctions on Mali. Does this mean now that ECOWAS is completely satisfied with the transitional process in Mali?
Yes. If you look at the statement announcing the lifting of sanctions, the chair of the ECOWAS authority and Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, called on all the Malian government to comply with other demands by the regional body, which I've severely seen have now been fulfilled. And it was against that background that the lifting of the sanction came into process. You know, there's a new government. Not only that, we've also seen that the cabinet has also been formed, which is like a new government.
Thank you very much for making the time to talk with us.
Thank you.
Aderemi Ajibewe is the Director of Political Affairs for the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. He was speaking with us from the Ivory Coast capital, Abidjan. Mali's fate as it prepares for a transition from military to civilian rule could set the tone for peace and stability in West Africa's Sahel region, says the U.S. top envoy to the region. Special Envoy J. Peter Pham recently visited the region and says that while the upcoming elections are a positive sign, much more work needs to be done. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
This June, Mali plunged into turmoil, with tens of thousands of protesters filling the streets to rail against corruption, economic insecurity, and the worsening security climate. Officials both in the Sahel region of West Africa and abroad, including the United States' top envoy to the region, were sounding the alarm. And then, on August 18th, came a military-led coup, the nation's second in a decade. The bloodless coup succeeded in toppling President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. The new military rulers vowed to relinquish control and hold fresh elections. Since then, the West African country has seen a flurry of political changes. This week, interim President Ban Dao named a transitional government to lead Mali back to civilian rule, but put several high-level members of the military putsch in key positions. And so, says J. Peter Pham, the U.S. envoy, this is a delicate time, both for Mali and its neighbors. He visited the region last week to meet with officials and to urge elections within 18 months. He spoke to journalists this week by phone.
In my meetings with transition government officials, I emphasized that the transition government must first and foremost focus on preparing for those elections. But at the same time, they also have to protect the population, as well as undertake some priority reforms to address the underlying grievances of the Malian people, including in the areas of electoral process, anti-corruption, protection of human rights, and implementation of the Algiers Accord, the agreement for peace and reconciliation in Mali. If they don't address these concerns, political instability may well return.
Pham has long expressed concern about rising extremist violence in the Sahel. For several years, UN peacekeepers and U.S. forces have maintained a multi-billion-dollar peacekeeping mission in the region, though the Trump administration has publicly questioned the value of the mission and pushed to cut budgets and troop numbers in Africa. VOA asked him if there had been any observable fallout in the region since the coup.
We haven't yet, and I think part of that is owing to ongoing activities by the United Nations peacekeeping mission, Operation Barkhane, and the joint G5 joint force, that we have not seen an uptick in violence across the region, but we certainly are keeping a very close eye on the situation, and certainly that danger persists.
So what will it take to stabilize the Sahel? On this, Pham was clear. Eradication of violent extremist groups, reforms in all sectors of government, and elections that bring in civilian leadership within 18 months. In short, he said, accountable governance, where leaders respond to their citizens, leave power when their terms end, and respect human rights. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera arrived in neighboring Tanzania on Wednesday for a three-day visit. The Malawian president has been touring a number of East African countries in recent weeks as he prepares to assume the chairmanship of the Southern African Development Community, SADC. He has visited Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique. Chakwera won Malawi's court order presidential election rerun in June this year as an opposition candidate. His visit to Tanzania comes as Tanzania is in the midst of a presidential campaign in which President John Magufuli is seeking re-election for a second term. Sean Kampondini is President Chakwera's director of communications.
Well, his purpose is twofold. One, he has committed himself to stimulating the economy, and the economies of Tanzania and Malawi are inextricably linked. And so he has come to reach agreements and strike deals related to trade Secondly, President Magufuli is the outgoing chair of the SADC community, while President Chakwera is the incoming chair. And so this is part of Dr. Chakwera's effort to ensure that there is a smooth transition in the leadership of the SADC bloc.
So Malawi is a landlocked country. How would you describe the level of trade between Malawi and Tanzania?
Well, His Excellency Dr. Lazarus Chakwera describes Malawi not so much as a landlocked country, but as a land-linked country, because we have linkages to our bordering nations, Zambia on one side, we have Mozambique on another, and we have Tanzania on another. These are all countries we are able to trade with because we are inextricably linked to them by commerce, by trade, by geography, by history, by culture.
Both countries are members of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, and President Chakwera has been visiting countries in the region, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Zambia. Is President Chakwera performing some regional diplomatic mission here?
That's right. President Chakwera is going to be taking over the chairmanship of the SADC bloc of countries beginning next year. In fact, Malawi is going to host a SADC summit next year. And so he has seen to it that within the first 4 months, the first quarter of his presidency, he travels around the region and builds rapport with his counterparts and establishes those brotherly linkages with those nations and reaffirms Malawi's commitment to those relations, as well as Malawi's general commitment to multilateralism. But at the same time, these are all nations with which Malawi has various agreements, not only at the SADC level, but even at international platforms such as the African Union and the United Nations. Malawi to have that kind of leverage, it means the support of its neighbors.
Does he plan to meet with members of the Tanzanian opposition?
He does not plan to meet with members of the Tanzanian opposition on this trip, but he has reiterated his commitment to democratic values and has conveyed to his counterpart, His Excellency President John Magufuli, of Malawi's full support with governance institutions in Tanzania, but also of the democratic process currently underway. The president has seen to it that as a friendly neighbor to Tanzania, he would not interfere with the internal affairs of Tanzania.
Sean, thank you very much again. We're so happy to speak with you.
Thank you, James.
Sean Kampondeni is Director of Communications for Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera. You are speaking with us from the Tanzanian capital, Dodoma. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 8th. Africa's response to COVID-19 has gained global recognition for its fast and targeted action. The Africa Centers for Disease Control has helped direct the continent's 54 countries into an alliance, praised for responding better than some richer countries, including the United States. Africa has registered 37,000 deaths since the first case was announced, compared to more than 210,000 in the United States. As Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa, health experts weigh in on what's behind the response.
In late February, after Egypt confirmed Africa's first COVID-19 cases, John Nkangasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control, called a high-level meeting of health ministers. More than 40 ministers from around the continent scrambled to Addis Ababa on February 22nd. Nigeria's health minister, Osagie Ehanire, even changed his schedule while on a trip to Europe to be present. Within days, Nkangasong tells VOA in an interview, Africa CDC had produced the Africa Joint Continental Strategy for COVID-19, a blueprint to coordinate government action to combat the coronavirus. Zimbabwe, which had not yet confirmed its first case, preemptively implemented a full state of emergency that restricted flights and large gatherings. In South Africa, a lockdown was implemented on March 27 before even 1,000 COVID-19 cases had been recorded. Nkangasong says case numbers in places like South Africa could have been more than twice as high if such drastic action hadn't been taken.
That momentum that we have developed in Addis Ababa became the galvanizing force for countries to do what we have agreed on. COVID-19 crisis has exposed the divisions that exist in the world and then but also exposed the unity on the continent. I think the continent has come together more than I've ever seen in by 30 years of public health practice.
While Nkangasong says factors such as climate conditions, the average age of citizens, genetics and antibodies from pre-existing infections may have led to a lower number of deaths, the sense of urgency back in February also contributed. In June, the Africa CDC launched a joint procurement platform so governments can get protective personal equipment and other medical supplies. A testing campaign has resulted in more than 15 million tests being conducted across the continent to date. Nkangasong said that South Africa, which holds the rotating presidency of the African Union, convenes talks between heads of state and the Africa CDC once a month, and a campaign has recently been designed to coordinate how people in Africa travel through airports.
Put in more than 10,000 community healthcare workers, over 200 responders, that is epidemiologists, infection control people across multiple countries there. So I think for Africa, we've done the best with the limited resources that we have.
Emmanuel Agogo, country representative for Resolve to Save Lives, a team of global health experts aiding governments on their COVID-19 strategies, said in an interview that the reason for fewer deaths in Africa remained a mystery. But he said a younger demographic, the fact many of the first cases were constrained to wealthier people entering the continent via plane, and the high number of people using antiviral medicine could all have contributed. Agogo says a World Health Organization initiative of joint external evaluations, which helps countries to prevent, detect and respond to public health risks, bolstered the ability of governments to act quickly.
By doing that, they actually knew where the furniture was, so they knew the gaps in their preparedness, and they all developed national plans.
Agogo said that countries in Africa deserved kudos for implementing safety measures despite the economic fallout from doing so. And the Africa CDC had learned much from coordinating responses with the likes of Ebola in Congo and Lassa fever in Nigeria. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Zimbabwe teachers are still refusing to return to the classroom as schools reopen from COVID-19 closures. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe, like other African countries, is trying a phased reopening of schools after closing in March due to COVID-19. But many teachers, like 33-year-old Munyara Zimasiwa, are refusing to return to class, pointing to low pay and unsafe conditions. Masiwa says he makes more money selling brooms than teaching at Cranbourne Boys Government High School in Harare.
We have got the zeal, we love the kids at school, but only if the government manages to capacitate us. We are under incapacitation situation. We're in a situation where we cannot raise transport fares for us to connect our home and our workstation. If we have got food at the table, and also the most important thing, we need to have a living wage of 520 USD. The salary that we were getting in 2018 is just the restoration of our dignity. I will be happy to report for duty.
Zimbabwe's teachers say they want at least $500 per month and equipment like masks, face shields and hand sanitizer to protect themselves against COVID-19. Zimbabwe's cash-strapped government says it has procured $6 million worth of PPEs for schools. Public Service Minister Paul Mavima says teacher salaries about $100 a month, including a $75 COVID-19 allowance, is all the government can afford.
It is within this context that we are saying to the civil servants, please be realistic, exercise moderation in the manner in which you demand salary increases. We don't want salary increases that will upset the stability that we have so far realized and further torpedo the economic recovery that we have started to see.
Without teachers in class, Zimbabwe school children are the ones left paying the price. At Glenview High School, students say they only discuss lessons among themselves. Fielda Rusheje is one of their parents. She's worried the children won't learn enough to pass their exams. She says the situation at schools is a tough one. They are going to school, but they are not learning. My daughter says they are just discussions among learners. They are not even sure if it's making sense because teachers are not coming, she says. I just wish if the government can negotiate with the teachers so that our children can learn. I want them to look after us in future, she says. Zimbabwe's government has threatened to replace defiant teachers like Masiwa if they do not soon return to the classrooms. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
The United States is conducting a nationwide census that helps determine the amount of federal funding for cities and states. So, when a federal judge extended the census for another 4 weeks, Somali-American volunteers in the Midwest state of Minnesota reached out to members of the diaspora to get them counted. Maxima Mascade has our story from Minneapolis, as narrated by Phil Durkin.
Mohammed Ibrahim and Hudu Dahir are going door-to-door to make sure their Minneapolis neighbors are being counted in this census. They say the response rate among Somali Americans in some neighborhoods of the Minnesota capital is less than half. Jelani Hussein is the executive director of the state chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
The funding from the federal government is tied with this census. So many programs that Somali communities and other minorities need or benefit from depend on how the census is executed. The housing, health care, schools, and home care are all affected. If we don't count and the federal government cuts or reduces the funding, that will hurt big time.
Community volunteers say some people are reluctant to complete census forms because they are concerned about how their information is going to be used. This outreach program hopes to ease uncertainties about the 2020 count.
We want people to know that this is urgent and important, and everyone should take part. Even those who fill the forms, we want them to talk to their neighborhood. We want them to call relatives and other people as well, so that everyone is counted.
Phil Dierking for Mahmoud Masade in Minneapolis.
And that's it for this Thursday, October 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.